internationally known for his work on environmental issues, S. Fred Singer, Ph.D., pioneered rocket and satellite technology. His following presentation is titled Manned Expedition to the Moons of Mars.
As a luncheon speaker, I'm supposed to do three things. I'm supposed to provide some information, I'm supposed to provide some inspiration, and at the same time, I'm supposed to provide some light entertainment. I'll try and do my best. Now, Tom Bethel yesterday gave me a chance to link the planet Mars, which is my aim here, to climate change. And he wondered why the ice caps on Mars were shrinking. And it was concluded, I believe, that the Martians have been using too many SUVs. Now, I personally don't believe that that's a very viable hypothesis, but if it makes some people happy, that's okay. I do want to use that occasion to say a few words about climate change, because that has been a kind of my trademark in the last few years. Unfortunately, spending too much of my time on that and not enough time on Mars, which is what I really would like to do. Let me say, first of all, that I agree completely with what was said yesterday by Willie Soon and by George Taylor. So I have no difference of, there's no light between us. We have no difference of opinion. Let me summarize what I think are the three main points, which will help you in arguments with global warming promoters, enthusiasts, and zealots. Number one, even if it is warming, and there's some dispute about that because not all the data show this, even if it is warming, I don't know of any firm evidence that would demonstrate that this warming is caused by human activities. In other words, the pattern of warming does not correspond to what one would expect from greenhouse models. The second point, which was touched on yesterday, generally speaking, a warmer climate is better than a colder climate. People seem to realize that because they're voting with their feet. I mean, no one goes to North Dakota these days for a vacation or to retire or to Northern Canada. I want to be kind to our Canadian cousins here. It's actually a logical argument that you can make. Everyone agrees that a colder climate is bad. Well, if a warmer climate were bad also, the only logical conclusion is that the present climate must be the best of all possible climates. I'll ask you, what's the probability of that? And the answer is zero. The third point is that nothing we can do about it anyway. And that was brought out well yesterday. The Kyoto Protocol, at best, even if it is punctiliously observed by all the countries that have ratified it, will produce a change of 0.02 degrees by 2050. That's 200th of a degree. You can't even measure that. Okay. If you want to know more about climate change, I have a website. I'll give you the address right now. It's www.SEPP.org. When I get home by tomorrow morning, I will put on this website an announcement of how you can access this information in three different ways. Either automatically by receiving an email every week, or by looking at your browser, or the third, by looking at the website, if everything else fails. Now, you'll also find an announcement about what we consider to be the biggest problem, climate problem, facing us, which is the coming ice age. There's no question that there will be another ice age coming. The question is how soon. We've had 17 ice ages in the last 2 million years, each lasting around 100,000 years. And in between, a warm period called the interglacial of about 10,000 years. We're now in the interglacial called the Holocene, which has been going on for 10,000 years. So it's about time for another ice age. However, humans are very clever people. We're smart. We have knowledge and engineering skills. Maybe we can beat the game. Maybe we can do something about a coming ice age. So we've organized a small symposium to be held, of all places, aboard ship in the Baltic, a region which was covered by an ice sheet about a mile thick until just 5,000 years ago. The perfect place to discuss what to do about the coming ice age. My website tomorrow will carry some information of how you can get onto this cruise. I have nothing to do with it as a travel agent who handles all this. You're most welcome to come if you find that fits in with your plans. Now, you notice that I have been giving you three choices right along on different things. And you wonder, why always three? Well, I'll tell you my story. It started a long time ago when I was a boy, and I was forced to study Latin. I hated it. I remember that. I remember the first sentence I ever learned in Latin. I'll never forget it. It's Sicilia insula est. Last year, for the first time, I went to Sicily, and I proudly displayed my knowledge of Latin to the people of Sicily. And said, Sicilia insula est. And they were amazed, not only at my fluency in Latin, but at my great knowledge of geography, because up till then, they hadn't realized that Sicily was an island until I told them. Now, I also remember the last sentence I learned in Latin. That was after 3 heavy years of study. It comes from a book by Julius Caesar, called De Bello Gallico, The Gallic Wars, in which he describes his experiences in Gaul, subduing Gaul. And the reason I remember that sentence is because I did something terrible. I think I kicked some kid I got into a big fight. Anyway, I was forced to memorize the first page of the book. I still remember the first sentence, which is, Gallia omnia est divisa in partes tres. It means Gaul is divided into 3 parts. Ever since then, I've divided every speech I give into 3 parts. I figure if it's good enough for Caesar, it's good enough for me. So what I will do now is to discuss my topic in 3 parts. The first part, I will go to give you some anecdotes going back hundreds of years about this subject. The second part, I will give you a proposal of how to explore Mars via its moon Deimos. Imagine that you are the administrator of NASA, Mike Griffin, and I will give you my proposal and try to convince you that this is the way to go. And finally, the third, I will discuss some thoughts I have about the future of the space program, which are not quite so optimistic. But I hope I may be wrong. I hope they're realistic. Well, about the anecdotes. The moons of Mars, you know, Mars has 2 moons, Phobos and Deimos, were first mentioned 300 years ago in Gulliver's Travels by Jonathan Swift. And he describes how Gulliver met up with the Laputan astronomers, and they tried to tell Gulliver how clever they were compared to the astronomers on Earth. They said, no, we're much better, we have better telescopes, and we can tell you that Mars has 2 satellites, 2 moons, Gulliver was amazed. He didn't know that. Well, I'm amazed too. How did Gulliver, or how did Jonathan Swift know that Mars had two moons? He described their orbits, and they seem to be pretty much like what we observe. It's all in the book. One theory is that Jonathan Swift was a Martian who had come to the Earth, and I know about this theory, hypothesis. I don't think it's very plausible. No. There must be another reason. I don't know. So that goes back 300 years. 100 years ago, just before my time, believe it or not, 100 years ago, the moons of Mars were actually discovered in my backyard at the Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C., by Asaph Hall in 1870. And the story is that he had an assistant, and came time for Thanksgiving, and he sent him away on a visit his family or something because he didn't want to share the credit with his assistant. And he's now listed as the discoverer of the moons of Mars. Yes, he did. He discovered them. He photographed them. He observed them for the first time. So it goes back then 135, 136 years that we have no, astronomically speaking, about the existence of the Martian moons. And we have observed one interesting fact, that the innermost moon, Phobos, is changing its orbit measurably. Its orbit is shrinking. It is approaching Mars and will eventually hit the surface and disappear. We may be the last ones to see Phobos in existence, because 5 or 6 million years from now, it won't be around. That's a pretty valid conclusion. And now I go back 50 years for my third anecdote. Remember, there was three. And this comes from a Russian astrophysicist, famous astrophysicist, Shklovsky. Famous because of his theory of supernova. But, you know, even famous scientists have their, shall I say, weak points. Anyway, one day we picked up the New York Times. I think it was 1957 or 58, just after Sputnik went up, and read this fantastic story about Shklovsky in the Soviet Union hypothesizing about Phobos. What he said was, Phobos has been spiraling into Mars, and therefore something is causing it, and he thinks it's the atmospheric drag of the Martian atmosphere. Well, Mars doesn't have much of an atmosphere, and particularly that altitude, that distance from the surface of Mars, the atmosphere of Mars as it is pretty thin. So how would it slow down Phobos? Well, said Shklovsky, I'm well aware of this. There's only one answer. Phobos must be a balloon, a huge object, very, very thin skin, a very, very low mass. So high area to mass ratio, and he calculated that if the area to mass ratio is high enough, then the Martian atmosphere should be sufficient to cause it to spiral in. But then he took his final leap and said, how is it possible for a celestial object to be constructed like a balloon? There's only one answer. It was manufactured by Martians. So we all read that. We had a great big chuckle about this and said, yeah, very, very funny, very funny. But it still didn't explain why Phobos spiraled in. Fortunately, I had a colleague, much senior to me, much more experienced, much smarter, Ernst Öpik, an Estonian astronomer, whom we had brought to the University of Maryland. And he immediately said, well, it must be tidal friction. And that is, of course, the answer. But it raised the story about Shklovsky really made the headlines and it caused a lot of discussion. And I remember one astronomer, an American astronomer, Tom Barr. Perhaps you know the name? working in New Mexico, writing a piece in the Journal of the AIAA in which he objected to Shklovsky's hypothesis. What was his objection? Well, he said, this would have been such a huge project, it would have ruined the Martian economy. It was serious. So, almost 50 years ago, then, in the last 50 years, I have been concerned with the Martian satellites. I have published three papers on their origin. I know the first two are wrong. It's always good to discover your own errors. The third one may also be, but so far I have not yet, or nobody else has objected to it. Maybe just don't read what I write. Anyway, I will now do the second part of my presentation, which is the proposal. Why we must explore Mars via its moon Deimos. And I'm talking about manned exploration. And I want to explain why manned exploration of Mars via Deimos is a better proposition than doing a series of unmanned missions, as we're doing now, or going all the way, which means to establish a manned base on Mars, as some have advocated. So let's see if this thing works. Ah, yes. Maybe we should turn the lights down a little bit so you can see Mars in all of its beauty. This is a picture taken from the Hubble Space Telescope. The color balance is not quite right. It should be a little redder. We played with it yesterday, but we couldn't get it quite red enough. We'll keep working on it and make it more red as time goes along. Well, you've all seen this. This was taken when Mars was closest to the Earth about a year ago. You see the ice caps, which, according to Tom, are shrinking. No big problem. They'll come back again. Mars, as you know, has an inclination. The Mars axis is inclined, and it fluctuates considerably because it doesn't have something like a moon to stabilize its obliquity. That's an astronomical point, which I don't want to belabor. But these polar caps are seasonal. They change back and forth. During the summer, it's up there, and the winter, it's down there. You know, so that's all been observed and well documented. What you probably haven't seen are pictures of the moons. There are not too many. Unfortunately, not too many people share my great passion for Phobos and Deimos, so they haven't taken too many pictures. But they're wonderful pictures. Here is Phobos. It looks like some kind of an animal, doesn't it? Here it does, some kind of a thing that swims in the ocean. Well, this is a famous crater called Stickney, gouged out some time ago. You'll see craters all over the place here. You see these rills, grooves. People have speculated about those. There are a lot of mysteries about Phobos, why it looks the way it does. One great mystery is the fact that its density is less than the density of rock, suggesting that it might just be a rubble pile with voids in its interior. No one has obtained samples of Phobos. It's been bad luck. The Russians tried first, did not succeed, and there have been other attempts to get samples of Phobos. None of them have succeeded, so we don't know what it's made of. But it isn't cheese, like the Earth's moon. It looks something like an asteroid. So the first guess was, but maybe it's a captured asteroid. At least that's what I guessed. Doesn't work. No, doesn't work. Okay, let's look at Deimos, which is even less well known. These are rocks about the size of Manhattan. Relatively small pieces. Hardly any gravity to them. You can tie up to them. If you take a leap, you'll probably depart and not come back. I once worked out that if you stand on Phobos and you throw a baseball horizontally, it'll circle Phobos and hit you in the back of the head. So you can it's easy to establish satellites for these moons because of their low gravity. Okay, let's go into the proposal. I think we're all agreed, and I will now address the administrator of NASA, that we need a national space program with a single overarching goal. We don't have that. The space station is not a goal. It's a means to an end, but they haven't discovered what the end is. Nobody knows what the end is. It's a means. It'll die soon, and it'll be a big, big white elephant, having wasted approximately close to $100 billion. Okay, so maybe we learn something from it, which is not to do that sort of thing again. Unfortunately, the next big white elephant is a base on the moon. There's no question it can be done. Then what? What do you do with it? What's it good for? No one really knows. So we do want a manned exploration. Having unique scientific content, non-publicity stunt, and the answer obviously is Mars. Mars is, I think, the best object for scientific study. We've been to the moon. In any case, the moon can always be explored robotically. We're close enough to the moon to really do robotic operations very simply. On Mars, it's very difficult because it's so far away. So there's a big time delay in getting instructions back and forth. And you have to have a human presence at or near Mars in order to do an efficient job. So we want to establish a base on Deimos. Why Deimos? It's easier than Phobos, but Phobos will do if it turns out that that's what the engineers tell us. The point is that we can do it faster than going a base on Mars. You can do it within 10 or 15 years. It's better than a series of unmanned probes, and it's cheaper than any of the alternatives. And it's within the current NASA budget. Very, very important. It's faster, better, and cheaper because it basically, when you think about it, it involves simply a transfer of a manned capsule, a habitat, from Earth orbit to Mars orbit. No landing on a big planet, no taking off, no big risks, just the transit back and forth. Okay, here's some information about Phobos and Deimos. They're in near circular equatorial orbits. This explains why they cannot be captured asteroids. The probability of being in equatorial orbits would be infinitesimally small. Mystery of origin, capture asteroid, no. Co-formation, no. One clue is that the Deimos is in a near-synchronous orbit. That is, it has the same period of orbital revolution as the rotation of Mars. Nearly the same. And Deimos will be the ideal base. It has low gravity, essentially zero escape velocity. This means you don't have to use a rocket to land and no rocket to take off. And you can build shelter from environmental hazards using the material that's there. It's an ideal base. What are the fundamental science goals? I have three of these. Are you surprised that there are three? Well, don't be surprised. Remember Julius Caesar. The first one, of course, is how do planets develop? We only have one planet called the Earth that we know something about. We'd like to have at least one other planet that we can test our theories on. And Mars happens to be, in many respects, like the Earth, in many respects. It's smaller, of course, but it rotates, it has an atmosphere, it has had volcanoes, it has had an ocean, it has had a magnetic field. Somehow these things have disappeared. Why? Well, let's find out. What happened to the oceans of Mars? What happened to the magnetic field of Mars? What happened to volcanism? Is it still going on? Good question. So planetology is one object. The second one is climate history. Again, we'd like to be able to study the climate history of a planet similar to that of the Earth to test our theories of climate change. This is no longer a question. It is now pretty well established that Mars at one time was wet and warm. We know that this climate is changing as the spin axis of Mars moves back and forth. We'd like to know if Mars had climate cycles like those that existed on the Earth. And we want to know if our climate models are good enough to explain climate changes on Mars. After all, if the model constructed for the Earth is really valid and not just tuned to the Earth, it should be applicable to Mars as well. And finally, the big, big question, origin of life. It's the biggest question. There's no doubt about it. We would either look for the existence of fossil life forms, that is, life may have existed and have disappeared, or of cryptolife, that is, life that's hidden, still existing but hidden, maybe under the surface. There are many examples on the Earth of both fossil life, of course, and of cryptolife, of life that's hidden. We have discovered life in rocks in the Earth. We've discovered life in the ice. Life in all sorts of unlikely places on the Earth. It may well exist on Mars. And, of course, there are interesting questions about biochemistry. Was life similar to that on the Earth? Did they have the same amino acids? Are there others? What about evolution? Did life evolve in a similar way? And so on. Is the morphology of life on Mars, I'm extrapolating, of course, similar to that of Earth? And so on. All kinds of questions. There are even philosophical questions and even theological questions. So, the project, as I say, can be done faster. We have essentially all of the technology. It just requires a rocket, propellants, to transport a habitat from Earth orbit to Mars orbit. Once you're there, Deimos provides shielding and shelter against meteor streams, cosmic rays, and solar flares. We can build on the experience of the space station and programs that are now going on in NASA. I hope they're still going on. No showstoppers as far as we can see. There's nothing really that stands in its way. It'd be nice if we had a nuclear rocket. We don't. We don't need it. It can be done without it. It'd be nice if we had this and that. We don't have it. We don't need it. We have adequate technology to do the job. And the project should be attainable in 10 to 15 years, if we put our minds to it. Don't forget, the Apollo program was done in a shorter time than that. It was much more difficult than the project we're talking about here. Better? Obviously, yes, but it needs to be explained. The exploration of Mars itself can be done by unmanned rovers controlled in real time, that's very important, with no time delay, from a human controller sitting on Deimos. The time is short. It's a fraction of a second. It's within the reaction time of a human being, which means you can drive the rovers robotically. You don't have to take one step at a time, as we're doing now with our rovers, going back to JPL every time to ask, well, can we take the next step? And the guy says yes or no. And then you tell the rover, yes, you can take a step, or no, you can't take a step. The rover comes back, yes, I've taken my step, and here's what I say, can I take the next step? You don't have to do that. The most important thing is that these robots, these telerobots, can return data, and not only data, but samples to Deimos. And then you can immediately evaluate these samples with instruments and allow sequential exploration. In other words, if you find something interesting, you can get the next sample within hours, not within years. That's very important for an experimenter. And now you can set up a complete scientific laboratory on Deimos. In fact, it's easier than setting it up on Earth. Why? If you've ever worked with a laboratory instrument, like the one that Noah described earlier, you know the big problem is the vacuum system. Getting the vacuum system to work and keeping it leak-proof is anybody who's ever worked in a physics lab knows that's a huge problem. It doesn't exist on Deimos. Vacuum comes free of charge. So the instrument becomes extremely simple, whether it's a mass spectrometer, electron microscope, an ion electron microscope, and so on. Extremely simple. You can also do sorties to Phobos for data collection, perhaps even a manned sortie to satisfy the space cadets. But another thing I would do is to establish a propellant factory, a prototype at least, on the surface of Mars to see if some of the schemes that people have suggested for making propellants on Mars will really work. Maybe they do, maybe they don't, but it's a way of testing. Finally, cheaper. Much, much cheaper than establishing a base on Mars, a human base. Cheaper even than having a series of unmanned missions over, let I say, the next 50 years. You can assemble everything gradually in Earth orbit. No hurry. You then have a slow... Oops, what did I do wrong here? Better? Cheaper? Yes. I hit the wrong button. And I'm okay now.
You're okay.
I'm okay now, yes. You're talking about something like 30 tons. Mostly propellants. Mostly chemical propellants. Cheap, very cheap. We know how. We've got lots of experience with that. You preposition a slow freight on Deimos on the cheapest route available. Maybe via L1. Whatever. The manned habitat, which is the crucial item, you have in orbit or on the Earth with a crew, and you test it out. You've got months to test it. Make sure that everything works. Make sure that the crew is compatible. Make sure you don't have a psychopath aboard or something like that. If you do, you know, put him out in the vacuum, send him back or something. Then, when you're ready, send the habitat in the fastest possible route. Even if it costs more in propulsion, if you can save time, there are trade-offs. There are big trade-offs. I don't know what they are, but I'm sure they are, and they need to be investigated. It would be nice to have some of these technology developments, but they don't need them. Cost, $30 billion over 15 years, $2 billion a year, well within the current NASA budget. The main advantage over a planetary base, which is what many people keep thinking of, is that you don't have what's called a delta V penalty. Let me explain. If you want to land on the surface of Mars or the Moon, you have to fight against the escape velocity, which is 2 kilometers per second. In other words, you have to slow down your base, your vehicle. You can't just crash into Mars. You have to slow it down. It takes a lot of propulsion. And then if you want to bring them back, assuming that's the plan, if you want to bring them back, you have to have a big rocket to take off from Mars. No use having a small rocket operating for a long time. It's got to be a big rocket. The thrust has to be larger than the weight of the vehicle. For Deimos, you don't need a high thrust engine. You can always trade off, get the same delta V, same change in velocity, by having low thrust and more time. So you use one little existing small rocket engine, which is smaller, has less weight, a better mass ratio, and you don't need a big rocket. In fact, there are missions that have been investigated. I like the one that Chang Diaz, the astronaut, Frank Chang Diaz, has worked out. It calls it the lifeboat mission. It's one where you apply propulsion along the way to Mars. So it's not a free, you never get a freebie anyway. But you can get to Mars in 100 days, spend 30 days at or near Mars, spend 100 days in returning. That's less than a year, for the whole mission. Obviously, we need further trade-off studies. You know, how much does it cost to shorten the time? Can you shorten it further? Anything you can do to shorten the time of transit would be a gain, if you can do it for a reasonable cost. Okay, this is it. For those who are the space cadets in the audience, and there may be some at NASA, and maybe the administrator of NASA is one, I don't know, they're the follow-ons. Sure. After this first step, you can have a base on Mars. You can talk about habitation and colonizing Mars. You can talk about producing propellants on Mars. You can even terraform Mars and turning it into a planet more like the Earth. All of these things have been discussed by all kinds of visionaries. But this is not a job for visionaries. You've got to have some practical schemes. And I think the practical scheme is to go to Phobos and Deimos, and use that as a base. As far as economic returns, well, it's possible that Phobos and Deimos can become cheap sources for raw materials for all kinds of space construction. They're not only cheap, but since they have no gravity, they are accessible. You don't have to spend money to extract and transport material. So now that I've finished my presentation to the administrator of NASA, I fully expect him to adopt this, and I go to the White House and persuade the inhabitant of the White House to drop his plan for Moon and Mars base and adopt this. So now I come to the third part of my talk, approaching here now the end, and that is some personal reflections on what I think is really going to happen. I wish I could be optimistic. This whole idea of the Phobos-Deimos mission was developed in 1977. That's almost 30 years ago. I remember very well walking into the administrator's office, Jim Fletcher. Maybe some of you know him or knew him. He's now passed on. Jim Fletcher, great guy, said to me, "Oh, Fred, you're going off on a sabbatical, I see. Why don't you do some studies and tell us what we should do in space, anything." I got a magnificent grant from NASA, $8,000, I remember that, to do the study. I delivered the study in 1978. It has been sitting there all the time. And it'll probably continue to sit there as they struggle to finish the space station, as they struggle to plan the lunar base, and worse than that, if there's a change in the White House, as there must be, of course, the new inhabitant may have different ideas, and I think even the lunar base is not going to materialize, because inevitably people will come along and say, we've got better ways of spending the money than putting a bunch of people on the moon. We've been there before. There's no point doing it again. And to some extent, they will be right. So I leave you with this happy thought. Go back, make a date with Mike Griffin, the administrator, make a date with George Bush, the president, and please explain to him why we have to go to Mars via the moon Deimos. Thank you.
I'm just a little confused here, Fred. Better. Suppose that Phobos and Deimos didn't exist. Presumably what we could do is send the transport vehicle by slow gravity and then send a fast spaceship there to link up with it. And the purpose of that freight thing was to deliver instruments and so forth. And then we could presumably use that whole thing as a base to, say, send things down to the surface. What is the advantage over that of going to Deimos?
Very good point, Cork. If Phobos and Deimos did not exist, we could do everything I've described here by simply orbiting Mars. In the habitat just orbits Mars. Do everything that I've just described. What's the advantage of having Deimos as a base? Just its large mass and its existence shields us from half of the solid angle of cosmic rays. It shields us from solar flares whenever they come up, because we can simply walk to the other side. I have no idea how simple it is to walk or hop to the other side. It shields us against meteor streams. And it has enough material, substance, so you can build things. You can build a shelter. And who knows, you may find some goodies there. We don't know what's there. We have no idea. Yep. So it's a good thing they're there, Phobos and Deimos. For another reason, because it gives us a scientific problem that we can try to solve. How do they get there? We still don't know.
Okay. Now just an ancillary comment. Franklin Chang Diaz was a student of mine at Connecticut. And so, so I should tell you just a little bit about him because it's very inspiring. The kid grew up in Costa Rica, and his grandfather was Chinese.
That's right.
One day his grandfather said to his mom, "Mom, I'm going to America." And he wound up in Central America, and two generations later, along comes this self-described mongrel. And he had, I think, graduated from high school. And he'd always been kind of a Buck Rogers type when he was a kid, and he saw those satellites going overhead, and the Russian satellites, and he knew about the American space program, and he wrote a letter to Wernher von Braun and asked him what he could do to become an astronaut. And he got back a letter. Von Braun told him, "Well, I can't guarantee that you can become an astronaut, but I tell you what you have to do in order to become one. You have to come to the United States, you have to learn English, you have to study science and engineering." So he wound up, he lived with his cousins, the Zunigas, in Hartford, went to a crummy high school in Hartford to beef up his English. He got in fights because he was an ambitious kid. And he came to UConn as a physics and engineering major. And he wound up working for me for a couple of years, and then he wound up working for Quint Kessel when I ran out of support money and so forth. Then he went on to get his PhD in plasma engineering at MIT and then became an astronaut. He's been up seven times.
Well,
he's a remarkable kid.
I visited him in Clear Lake near Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And he's now building a plasma propulsion system.
At the University of Houston.
Right.
I
admired the work he's doing, but I just want to tell you, if it works, fine. If it doesn't work, we can still do it with chemical, good old-fashioned chemical propulsion.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you, Fred. A little aside about Mars that I use in a speech that I give at home that I got from the University of Hawaii Astronomy Department. that on the island of Hawaii, we have what's described as the world's most massive mountain, Mauna Loa. It's a 32,000-foot pile of rock, the first 18,000 feet of which is wet. But anyway, it is the second largest known volcanic shield or Hawaiian volcanic shield volcano. The largest one is Olympus Mons on Mars. And it's so much bigger on Mars because I understand Mars does not have tectonic activity like we do here. Just thought I'd throw that in.
Mars is still a great puzzle. The question of what happened to the oceans or to the water, let's put it this way, we're not really sure there were oceans, but is a very puzzling one. A number of us have worked on it. I have a small paper, which is very speculative. Obviously, all these things are speculative, but they're interesting. What happened to the magnetic field of Mars? It did exist at one time. We have evidence that of its previous existence, but somehow it has disappeared. So it has a lot of bearing on the Earth itself, because we still haven't solved the question of what is maintaining the Earth's magnetic field. Sure, we know that it's currents in the mantle, in the core, in the liquid core, but what is the energy source? Good question. Yes.
Hi. I just want to say that you shouldn't despair so much. I remember a couple of years ago in bitter cold in January, they had a lecture at the University of Toronto in Convocation Hall, and I went there after work, stood in line in bitter cold and bought a $5 ticket to get in, and I was just blown away by how many young people were sitting in the hall there to hear lectures by astronauts and also space people working in astrophysics talking about the future and the missions to Mars, and these kids were sitting there just soaking it up. They never thought about budgets or whether it was possible or not. They just captured their imagination, and I just couldn't get over it. And how young people in the bitter cold would go out at night to hear these lectures and all see all the slides and talk with these people, but there is a human spirit, and they want to go there, and it'll happen.
I remember the most exciting Mars conference I went to was in Toronto at Ryerson College, I think it's called. Ryerson? Yeah, okay. And it was given by the Mars Society. I'm somewhat skeptical of the societies that do this, because they attract, some would say all kinds of strange people, but including some who believe in Martians. The issue there is whether we should go to Mars directly from the Earth with one great big rocket, sort of like the Apollo program, or whether we should take the steps I've outlined here of first putting a habitat in Earth orbit, assembling it gradually, testing it, and just transferring it to Mars orbit. I really believe that that is the preferred method. It's safer, it's cheaper, it can be done sooner, and it has as much or even more of a scientific payoff. You see, even if you put a manned base on Mars, you cannot really explore all of Mars from that base. You have to have unmanned rovers, controlled from the base, of course. Well, how do you do that on Mars? Well, you have to have communication satellites to control them. Well, if you're going to do all that, you might as well sit off the surface and do the control. There's no advantage at all of being on the surface. In fact, it's hazardous. You'll be covered with dust most of the time in dust storms. You have the hazard of meteorite impacts. None of these problems, or at least as serious, on Deimos. You can protect yourself against all of these.
Professor Singh, I was intrigued by your triumvirate of ideas and then triplicates. I have a couple of questions and a suggestion. In this meeting, we've talked about the primary source of everything is an arrangement. The word is the source of everything. We've talked about the introns, the great deficit in the knowledge of what is the DNA all about. And you today have proposed the question, can we learn anything about the origin of life on Mars? Assuming that the arrangement of the biota on Earth is according to a plan rather than according to a random evolution, and assuming that the introns do something that hasn't yet been defined, we might ask, what is deficient in our knowledge? After all, we know all about the biochemistry now. And the answer, of course, is the morphology. We know nothing about the mechanism governing ontogeny of eukaryotes. Yeah. Is it possible that when we come to Mars, we will find pentadactyl creatures, etc., indicating that the plan is of a universal nature? I just thought I'd throw that in as the third question.
You know, I have very little expertise in biology or in astrobiology, but as a physicist, or as an atmospheric physicist, I know that on the surface of Mars, you have the full spectrum of solar ultraviolet, which severely would affect any DNA or any complicated molecule, plus the fact that you have the full intensity of cosmic rays. That may not be quite as serious, but the UV is a problem, and to our solar flares. So life on the conditions on the surface of Mars are not very hospitable for the development of life. On the other hand, knowing something about planetary physics, we know that Mars at one time must have had a thick atmosphere, which has now dissipated. So there was a period of time, possibly as much as a billion years, when Mars had a thick atmosphere, maybe not protective of UV, but certainly protective of some of the solar radiation, when it had water, and a magnetic field, which would, to some extent, shield against cosmic rays, to some extent. In any case, conditions on Mars have now changed, so it is, if life did develop at one time, it is very likely that it is no longer on the surface of Mars, but it may be underneath the regolith, underneath the soil, protected by the soil. Yes.
Many years ago, we had at this meeting, we had an interesting concept described by, I believe his name was Robert Zubrin, called Mars Direct. Are you familiar with his ideas, and what do you think of them?
I'm sorry, could you speak up?
A gentleman named, I think it was Robert Zubrin, did a presentation here on what a concept he called Mars Direct. He
worked. Yes, I mentioned that. He is the founder of the Mars Society, and he does have a plan called Mars Direct, and he would also make fuels on Mars to enable us to come back. That, I think, is a fairly risky proposition. However, you know, who knows? But first we have to demonstrate that fuels can be made, or propellants can be manufactured on Mars, and that's why I favor the idea of having a prototype factory to try to make propellants, see if it works. I would not trust a non-existent hypothetical propellant factory to bring back the astronauts, not at this stage at least.